And now we get to the what about this data part of the program. And again, the way we've set it up is a series. I shouldn't say we. I had nothing to do with this. Rich and Jim did. Set it up as a series of panels with lots of really good people on the panels. And the hope is there'll be some short presentations, I think. But the hope is you'll really get involved by asking your questions and raising your issues about the data. And then at the end of the day, I'll ask you one more time, what is it that you said today that you want us to hear? You know, what's the most important thing? So keep that in mind and give us a little more feedback. The two people who are coordinating this, and then I get to sit down and just listen. Jim Hedlin was in his past life, was the associate administrator at NHTSA for traffic safety programs. He's now doing consulting work with Human Factors North. More importantly, though, Jim was on the safety TCC for years and headed up the subgroup that was overseeing originally set up the analysis projects contract, which is the SOA. Rich Deering has now taken that over. He's now chairing the committee that's overseeing because Jim is now, I should say more importantly, Jim is now Sharp 2 staff. He's on the safety staff. Rich has 30-plus years, which makes him a really young guy to me. He has 30-plus years in automotive research, human driver performance, emerging technologies, crash avoidance work, runs a consulting firm now, in which he continues that work, and again, is a member of the Safety TCC Technical Coordinating Committee, and now is the chair of the group who oversees the four analysis projects that you're going to hear about. So having said that, I'll turn it over to one of the two of them, Rich.
Okay, now we get, now we get to the fun part. Now we get to the data and what we're going to do with it. I'm going to keep this brief. I never like to hear the moderator talk for very long. We've got four sessions set up here. I dare say the very first one is the one that's slide heavy. So we're going to bring up each of the four teams that are currently doing data analysis work on the Sharp 2 program, and let them give you background information on what they're doing and how they're doing it. I would ask you to try and restrict your questions on this session to clarification, because this work is nearly done, and deciding to redesign it now is not going to work. And with that, I think the first people that we want to bring up, Shauna, you want to come up and do the C3 presentation first? And I'm going to sit in the front row with a timer. So I think we got about 10 minutes apiece.
All right. So we have one of the SOA projects, and I'm with Iowa State University as well. You're seeing more of us than you probably want to see. And so ours is looking at driver behavior on rural two-lane curves. Oops, I guess I should have figured out how to run that before, huh? Is that right? Okay. So the reason for that is, as many of you know who do anything with roadway safety, the crash rate on curves is, depending on who you ask, three times higher on horizontal curves than it is for tangent sections. And that's obviously because curves require a different level of driver, you know, paying attention and doing things. 56% of fatal runoff road crashes are on curves are speed related. So we have some small amount of evidence that suggests that driver behavior is one of the major factors, but we don't really know much about that. So the objective is to be able to use the Sharp 2 data, which gives us this really unique opportunity to see what drivers are doing as they go around a curve and figure out what's the likelihood of a lane departure or crash, although we'll have not a lot of crashes in this data set, and driver behavior, and then also linking that with roadway, environmental, and in some cases vehicle factors if that's relevant. In order to start off the research, we came up with, this is just a sample of the research questions that we're trying to address, but basically we're trying to make some correlations between driver distraction and curve negotiation, so whether they successfully negotiate the curve or not, and what are they doing as they negotiate the curve or prior to the time they get to the curve. What's the relationship between speed, lateral positioning, and crash risk? There's a lot of studies out there that say speed is a major factor in crashes, but we actually really don't know that because we have very little actual evidence that says the person was speeding. So this is a really good opportunity to actually study the relationship between speed and crash and then the ability to negotiate a curve. And then also, from the perspective of traffic control devices and countermeasures, one of the research questions is, what roadway cues are drivers paying attention to? And, you know, what's getting their attention? What are they responding to? Because as traffic engineers, we like to, you know, put up signs everywhere, and they're not always effective. So it'd be nice to know, what are drivers looking at? What are they reacting to? And how does that help them negotiate the curve better? The analytical approach that we're suggesting is looking at focusing on single vehicle runoff road, multi-vehicle runoff road, and cross-center line, which is pretty much all of the crashes that happen on curves. There's an occasional rear end and a very occasional sideswipe, but or same direction sideswipe. So just looking at the crash types that are most likely related to curves, and then develop a model that sort of defines how the driver negotiates the curve. So what are they doing as they approach the curve, as they enter the curve and leave the curve, so that you can better understand what they're doing. And then basing all of that on roadway, geometry, vehicle, environmental conditions, and then things that are getting affecting the driver workload. So one question is, if you're going to say some measure of exposure, you have to have what's normal curve negotiation. So we have to define, you know, is that never touching a lane line? Is that a certain amount of deviation from the lane center? So defining that is one of the challenges. And then we're also going to identify roadway, driver, and environmental factors that are present. So there was chevrons on the curve, there was advisory signing. And then go ahead and develop predictive models. We've identified all the data needs. We don't have a lot of the data, but we've identified the needs. And so the first is the roadway data from SO4, which Omar talked about earlier. And that would include mobile mapping, state roadway databases, aerial imagery, and the forward view from the naturalistic driving study. There's some stuff that you can get from that you can't get from the roadway. Also, what the driver's seeing is the most recent snapshot in time of what's on the curve. So you could have a roadway database that says there's chevrons there, but, you know, when the driver drives the curve, they could now be over five chevrons. So it's also a way to sort of check what's out there. Then environmental factors, we can use either RWIS data, the front view from the NDS, wiper position, and engagement of, ABS. Too many acronyms. And then from the vehicle, obviously, we're working with the University of Iowa, and they're looking at the driver side, reducing the driver data. So you have actual data, like what was the driver doing? Were they eating something? And then there's also the pre-study data about the person. Driver distraction, driver response, so these are all the factors that you might use to figure out, you know, what's going on with the driver. Our modeling approach, we've actually picked out three different approaches sort of to answer three different types of questions. A time series analysis is one type. The reason for that is that you can use what happens in time t to predict what happens in time t plus 1. So you can actually include some effect of what the driver was doing in a time period before. So I won't get into the statistics. As I said, this is just a sort of a conceptual model right now. Then, because the results we hope will be useful to actual state and local agencies, bringing the data down and the analysis down to something that they can actually use and understand. So we've also proposed using data at the event level to do an odds ratio. So what's the probability of lane keeping given certain situations? And then the other, we may look at a generalized linear model, which uses the probability of deviating from the lane center. We're hoping that the results will be useful enough after phase two, probably not after phase one, that we can try providing information back to the Highway Safety Manual, the IHSDM, and the Crash Modification Factor Clearinghouse, ideally. We want to bring our information back down to the level of the people who will actually use it. The benefits is that we'll have a better understanding of how the driver and the roadway, everything interacts and why drivers do what they do and what they don't do successfully. We also hope to be able to get some insight into countermeasures. So if you have, you know, one type of advisory signing on one curve with similar characteristics and then different type of signing on another, why does one seem to work versus the other? And then the implications, hopefully, for the study would be improvements in road design, signing, selection of countermeasures, policy, and then some useful information to advanced vehicle technologies. Wow, I think that was better than 10 minutes, wasn't it? Do I get a prize? Okay.
All right, you know, David reminded me this morning with his talk that the analysis technique and the data you use depends both on the question that you want to ask and sometimes the answer you think management would like you to get. You're going to find, as you look across these four studies, I think we picked four very different problem approaches that are going to exercise the data set very well. Next, if we could have Karen talk about the MRI team.
This work? Yes. Okay. My name is Karen Bauer, and I'm actually with MRI Global now. And for those who don't know that, it used to be a Midwest Research Institute, but March of last year, we decided to change our names. Everything's still the same. I still work in the same group. I work in the Transportation Research Center at MRI Global under the supervision of Doug Harwood. I think a lot of you guys know him. So my co-PI is Jessica Haddon. I'm a statistician, and Jessica is, thank God, the traffic engineer. So what we have decided to study and proposed is the evaluation of left turn lanes at intersections, and about 8 to 9% of fatal crashes at intersections are involving left turn maneuvers. And so we would like to study how offset, the amount of offset left, I mean negative, positive, or no offset, how it affects the behavior of the driver when they turn. And they also, there is very little guidance on how to build those intersections. There is none in the Green Book, in ASHTO's Green Book, and highway agencies would like to have some guidance as well. So that's basically the outcome, is to provide some guidance on, you know, what is a desirable offset to minimize crashes and improve safety at intersections with offset left turn lanes. So the basic research question, I don't have to look up there, is, you know, do various left turn, do various offsets have actually an impact on gap acceptance? Because this is basically what we will be looking at when we get the data, is what is the gap that the driver either accepts or rejects. So that will be our most important dependent variable, so to speak. And the other thing that we want to do while we are looking at those videos is the effect of whether there is a driver on the opposite side that turns left as well, whether that impacts the behavior of the driver that's in the vehicle that's automated. And so hopefully we can answer some of those questions with this fantastic database. So here is a picture of what the three offsets really mean. And I'm a little bit out of water here because this is a transportation thing. But in the middle, you have the typical no offset and a zero offset, which is very popular on two-way left turn lanes. This is the one you probably see the most. Negative offset, Jessica told me you see it mostly on roadway divided with a median. And she said for the positive, it really doesn't occur that naturally. So I'm not sure if we're going to get a whole lot. Hopefully, we do get some data. There is some study that has been done. I think Bob Wan did some analysis of the effect of various offset amounts, but it has been fairly inconclusive. I think it was based on some fairly small data set in Canada, but he hasn't really come up with anything to hang his hat on. So that's why we have proposed to do this with this naturalistic driving study data. The next slide is about, you know, why this is so important. Well, when you turn left, you have a big issue with sight distance. And what we have here is up there, and I believe these are negative offsets. This is a negative offset in both cases. And what you have up there is what we call an unpositioned car. So it's sitting right there at the light if there is one. And then you can see the shaded area is hidden by the drivers in the opposite lane, and you really don't see what's going on. And so if you turn left, you take your chances by this car that's in the back there that wants to go straight. And then the same down here, this is a position car. It's already in the intersection, and then here comes a car, and you know, you have a potential for crash. So what we want to do is, with the data that we need, is the data that's collected by the radar that looks outside the vehicle. So from the car's perspective, there is a, I think, is it 90 degree or 100 degree, whatever, region from the front of the car where you can see whatever is happening. And so we will collect this data, and then we will analyze the video data and hopefully, and then write some algorithms on what is the gap that the driver accepts or rejects, and then analyze that data. So where we stand right now is we do not have any data yet per se. We have what we got is trip data. What we did, and this is a long slide, but we have, after we got our data sharing agreement in place, we have, and actually simultaneously, because we didn't need all of this at that point, is looking at the trip maps, identify where we, and you saw those earlier this morning, the ones with the red and the green, focusing on areas that have a lot of activity, and get the trip maps from C-Tree, and then some of our engineers looked at, used those intersections and looked at the GPS, and then went into Google Earth to identify actually a photograph of that intersection to see whether it fits our study. So that was a fairly long process, and I think at this time we narrowed it down to a few intersections, and then of those, we will then request the data that we really need to do the study. So this is the stage where we are right now. We are in conversations with VTTI on how to define, you know, so it can be programmed, the area of the intersection that we need, so we don't have to look at a whole lot of stuff. And so that's where we are right now. And so we have submitted a list. We have 84 turns at 36 intersections, and we actually did find, you know, this was a difficult part because it's not like there's a whole lot of those offset intersections out there. We have found 9 intersections with a negative offset, 15 with no offset, and 12 with a positive offset. And then we looked at the various turns that were made from those trip maps. And those trip maps were from some time ago, so I know there is a lot more activity on them right now. And then the plan is to take a sample of those and then get the video data looking forward and analyze our, hopefully, you know, put a plan together. So this is the type of data that we collected in from Google Earth and all the maps. And it's basically, we had to identify the major road, the minor road, the city it was in, left turn direction. It's very important that we only look, you know, you don't want to, we don't want right turning vehicles. We only want left turning vehicles. So we had to identify all of this. And this is the database that we send to VTTI, and now we're focusing on how can we extract, how can we basically put our arms around the data that we need for a sample of those. And ideally for this first phase, which is just a proof of concept, we'd like to have a few intersections of each type, you know, negative, positive, and no offset. And when there is an offset of various dimension, various amounts, because that is one of our important variables in the modeling, is not just looking at plus, minus, and zero, but if you do have an offset, does it matter? Is there kind of an optimal offset that reduces crash potential? So the next step then is, I think I just talked about that, is, you know, narrow the list of intersections. And we talk about this later, but, you know, we've done our IRB, and we basically, since we do not ask for any data that involves the driver, what's happening inside the car, we thought we were pretty safe on a lot of the stuff. But then we already heard that in our conversation this week, that if you have a trip of one single vehicle, it's the same vehicle that always goes into the same place at 7:15 in the morning, that, you know, sooner or later you could actually identify who that driver is, and so that's out. So as we go through our list, there will be some intersections that we just will not be able to include because there is potential for data confidentiality. And so we're learning that as we go along, and I think we are learning as we go along. So, But once we are there and we have a sample, then we will request the video after it has been narrowed down, and that's the process we're in right now, is how do we narrow down the video and who's going to do it. And then hopefully sometime this summer we get to actually have the data and analyze it. So the data capturing, the automated data capturing is, you know, getting, once you have the video, is looking at, you know, identifying what the driver is doing. And so these are the list of the variables that we need. And what we really want is that time it takes and how long. And then I have a quick slide on, we're not there yet. What we proposed in our proposal is the type of analysis approach. And the critical thing is, you know, the measures of crash risk, what are they? And we're looking at critical gaps, the percentage of drivers that accept certain gaps of certain length, and the rate of occurrence of erratic maneuvers, because we will also know whether from all sorts, from other data in the database, on whether they try to avoid, you know, turning or sudden braking and all of that. We want to analyze that too. And then the other thing we want to do, like I said at the beginning, is does it matter whether there is a vehicle in the opposing left turning lane and what the effect on risk behavior is there. And the type of modeling we have suggested is mostly logistic analysis, where you estimate the probability of accepting a gap of a certain length and then looking at it as a function of the amount of offset. And that's where we are. That's it. Yeah. Thank you. Well, yeah, we will have the drivers. I mean, we will have demographics on the age. And I'm not so sure we're going to do a whole lot in this initial study. This initial study, I think, is mostly to show that we can get the data that we need to then do the full study. But, yes, we're looking at demographics, you know, age, sex. I don't know what else we want to look at. And, of course, the intersection characteristics, too. You know, how many lanes, volume, and all of that. Yeah. I don't know at this point if I can answer that question. I think we're just going to take what we get, you know. But if we do have more than one left-turning lane, if there's a configuration, I am sure we will consider it in the full study. Yeah. Right. And those are all factors that we will put in our plan for the full study. Thank you.
Is there one in the back? I was going to let her off the hook.
A quick question. The intersections that you choose, do they need to be on the roadway network for which the roadway data is collected?
On which road network?
There is a roadway network in each of the six area that roadway data is collected separately from the naturalistic driving data. Do your intersection list need to be on that network? Because if that's the case, then you will have the alignment data around the intersection. If it's not, then you lack that data.
You mean whether we have the data that Omar is getting?
Yeah.
I mean, if we have intersections, you know, We can always identify the alignments and all the characteristics either through Google Map or by calling. I mean, we have contacts in the States with safety highway engineers in the various DOTs, and we can get the characteristics of the intersections if it is not in that roadway data. Yeah.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, to keep us moving, I think now we're going to go to Minnesota. Gary, tell us about rear-end crashes.
All right. Well, I suppose like everybody else, I got to know what's the right button to push. The right hand. Okay. That's a pretty uninformative title, okay, but it's the official title here, okay. I can refer to this project by its title, but it won't tell you very much anyway. My collaborators in this activity, John Hordos, director of the Minnesota Traffic Observatory, and Interdit Chatterjee, he's a doctoral student who's actually doing most of the actual work, okay, that the project is involving. The kind of event we're interested in is one that's depicted here. Okay, this is a rear-ending crash on Interstate 94 where it runs through downtown Minneapolis. And essentially what happened was there was a braking to stop shock wave. And as far as we were able to trace it, it started at least a quarter of a mile, okay, before this crash event here. And then finally, driver, when you look at the video, okay, essentially there's no indication of any evasive action at all, okay, on the part of the actual crashing driver. He just plows into the vehicle that stopped up ahead of him here. And you can see the congestion building up, okay, as a result of this event. You look at it for a while, you see the emergency vehicles coming to haul it away. All right, this is the sort of event we'd like to eliminate, okay, on I-94 in downtown Minneapolis and probably a lot of other places as well. Driver behavior is arguably, okay, a primary causal factor in this, okay, and so we want to learn a little bit more, okay, about what's going on in events like this. Our starting point is, I've shot this picture around several times, okay, is a set of ideas dating back to the early 1970s. Ed Brill, who got his degree from, big sidetrack. Anyway, essentially what's depicted here, okay, is a rear-ending crash event. And the upper numbers are the stopping distance that the following driver needs to come to a stop, and it has two components, his reaction distance and his braking distance. All right, the bottom numbers are the available stopping distance, and it has two components. It's his following headway, and it's the braking distance of the guy, okay, that's up ahead of him here. And what Brill showed, okay, was that if you take longer to react, okay, then you have to brake harder in order to stop within a given distance, okay, no brainer there. All right, but what happens then is when you stop in a shorter distance, that provides less distance for the guy behind you to stop, okay, and so you can get a possible cascading effect, okay, where each driver takes a bit longer to react, leaves less and less distance available for the guy behind him, okay, until a crash occurs. And we've got a little bit of limited evidence, okay, indicating that that sort of thing actually happens, okay. These are trajectories of seven vehicles involved in a rear-ending event, okay, on I-94 from a few years earlier. And the crash was between vehicles 6 and 7 down there at the bottom. All right, but what's interesting in this is this behavior of driver 3, who took about 4 seconds to react. And you'll notice that the deceleration that this driver had to use, the guy ahead of him, okay, decelerated about 6.5 feet per second squared. All right, driver number 3 had to brake at about 12.5 feet per second squared. Substantial increase, okay, in deceleration rate, okay, and accordingly a reduction in the available stopping distance available to everybody behind him. All right, this is the sort of event we're interested in. We call this a critical event, okay, where the driver takes, quote, long, unquote, to respond, has to brake substantially higher than the guy ahead of him. And when I presented this stuff in the past, a question that invariably comes up is, what was that guy doing, okay, to take that 4 seconds? All right, well, the naturalistic driving study should actually provide the sort of data needed to answer that kind of question. So an outline of our study, okay, the study idea. From the NDS, we want to get a sample of these braking to stop events, okay, on congested freeways. All right, from these, we will estimate, from the time series stuff, speeds, decelerations, following headways, reaction times of the drivers involved here. And then we're going to classify these events according to what we call their criticality, okay, and it's kind of vague what we exactly mean by that right now. All right, but certainly the follower's reaction time will have something to do with it. The follower's deceleration will have something to do with it. And then what we call this stopping distance loss, okay, the stopping distance taken away from the people behind you because you took a long time to react. All right, we'll also classify the following, or the behavior, okay, of the follower during the reaction phase. And this is going to mean going to VTTI's secure enclave, pulling out the face video corresponding to these things, okay, and then characterizing what the drivers were doing. All right, and then the simplest sort of statistical test you could do is an association, okay, between criticality and behavior here. As we've heard, okay, there's going to be thousands of vehicle years worth of data in the database when it's done. And so the first issue is trying to hone in on the events, okay, that we're interested in. And so what we did was we picked Seattle first, okay, because I used to live in Seattle, and I know there's a lot of congested freeway in Seattle. All right, Interjet went to the Washington DOT website, all right, and identified these sections of freeway, okay, where the Washington DOT says you got congestion. All right, he went to a geographic information system, got latitude and longitude boxes that characterized the sections of interest. All right, got some time bounds to indicate when the congestion typically occurred, and then we sent those off to VTTI and asked for all trip segments, okay, satisfying these latitude, longitude conditions and these time conditions here. So far, we've gotten a small pilot data set from VTTI. Okay, Miguel says that they're still working on some data quality checks, okay, that these haven't been subjected to. So we haven't agonized a lot over the analysis of this. All right, but there was a total of 37 trip segments, okay, in this set. 10 of those, unfortunately, were missing the forward radar range and range rate. And since we're interested in the interaction of the vehicles, that's crucial, okay, to our study. Of the 37, 4 trips had both radar range and range rate and also involved braking to stop events on the freeways here. And then another thing to notice is that whereas the most of the time series stuff is available at 10 hertz, okay, the GPS is only available at 1 hertz, and that generates some kind of technical issues, okay, that I'm not going to dwell on right now. All right, so a quick example, okay, of what we've done so far. Here's one of the braking to stop events on Interstate 5, okay, in Seattle. You can kind of see downtown Seattle down there in the horizon. Got it worked. All right, here's a time series plot of the range and range rate, okay, from the forward radar here, where you can see the blue is the range, and you can show the distance separating the two vehicles, all right, going down to close to zero there towards the end. All right, and then range rate is the difference of the speeds, okay, between these two vehicles, and you see that going to basically zero, okay, when they both come to a stop. Can't help it, okay? Every presentation I ever make has to have an equation in it. Essentially, the way this works is we say the vehicle state consists of its position and its speed, okay? And so this is a real simple state-space model. Position and speed is the state. That's the top equation. The bottom equation is what we can measure, and that consists of the speed of the follower, the range, and the range rate here. All right, and so we take the acceleration as a input sequence, and then essentially we try to just estimate the acceleration behavior. Once you've figured out where the changes in acceleration have occurred, you can get from that the reaction times, okay, and essentially that's how the whole mess works. Oops, that's lessons learned. That's supposed to be saved, all right, for the next presentation. All right, what's that? Okay, all right, so we'll bail out. So basically I was going to save my conclusions for the lessons learned session here right now that'll be coming up here. But what I'll say is so far, what we found out, all right, is that the sort of data that's available appears to be feasible for doing what we want. Interesting question, will there be a large enough sample size when the thing is finally done? It's not looking too unpromising, that too many negatives. Looking promising at this point here. And with that, I guess I'll stop. Okay, take questions if you have them. Thank you very much.
One quick question. Internal distraction, I think is what you're... Uh-huh. How do you plan to discern that?
The answer is vague at this point. All right, but essentially, if you're being distracted by something in the vehicle, that's an internal distraction. If you're distracted by something going on outside, that's an external distraction.
I drive home every day staring straight ahead. My mind is nowhere.
Yeah, well.
So I was just curious.
I don't know. Have we got any plans to put like EEG sensors on some of these drivers here? We can get some brain waves. I guess absent that, like I say, it's going to be a crude cut. Okay, good point.
When you're coding when you go through the video data, you're probably going to be coding it into some sort of data set.
Uh-huh.
Is there any plans on the whole with the Sharp 2 to make a published data set where people have gone through and taken the effort to code segments of video so that other researchers down the road can harness that data and also contribute to it?
I don't know what the answer to that is. Someone else might know more about what's going on.
I can take a stab at it. I believe the goal is to actually make these public at some point. I'm looking at Anne right now, too. She's nodding her head. So, yes, the data that can be shared in that way, because they're not identifiable, will be put up on the website once the contractors are done with their analysis and publications and et cetera and all that.
The more serious question is, if they do something to code this particular small data set, will that go and be coded for other trips that were not in this small data set? That's still very much up in the air.
Gary, one of the questions that I have in reference to this kind of activity, is it likely to be impacted, and if so, how? In vehicles that come equipped with CMBB, that is collision mitigation by braking, where the vehicle automatically slows down. And so in a way that obviates the necessity of looking at driver behavior, but this is the way we are headed for the future.
I'll answer that elliptically here. All right, and that is, this is an issue that came up, okay, down at the MTO just in the past couple weeks. All right, there's more and more interest in simulating, okay, the impact of these sorts of assistive technologies in traffic simulation models. And John's answer when he was asked about that was, well, it's pretty easy to simulate, okay, an automatic assistive technology. What's hard to simulate is the behavior of the unassisted drivers, okay? And they're still going to be out there for a while. And that's more like what we're focusing on here right now.
Okay, thanks.
Okay.
All right. You know, as a mechanical engineer, I don't mind the equation, but did it have to be in matrix format? And lastly, we do not have Trent Victor. We have John Lee for SAFER.
So, yes, Trent apologizes for not making it here. He was ill, and I'm taking his place a little bit at the last moment. So if I turn to the audience for answers to questions, forgive me. What I'll be talking about is developing an inattention risk function based on the naturalistic data, specifically tied to lead vehicle crashes as a first step. This sentence describes sort of the whole project, and I worry a little bit when you have to color code a sentence to make it parsable, but it's actually kind of useful, so I'll walk through it. So the main research question is really, how does driver inattention influence risk of crash severity? So how likely and how severe a crash will be depends, I think, on driver inattention. And we're going to operationalize in the blue there driver inattention in terms of measures of single glances and the glance history over time, and look at which one of those matters, which one matters more, does glance history matter at all maybe. And then the green delimits our scope to looking at lead vehicle pre-crash scenarios, so situations where the lead vehicle brakes or lead vehicle is moving slowly, similar to the presentation that we just heard. And the reason for that is that driver distraction is predominant in these sorts of crashes. And these crashes account for something like 30% of crashes, police reportable crashes. So it's a common crash scenario that's dominated by distraction. And this little diagram here shows what we're aiming for. What we want to do is identify a function that relates inattention to risk. And this inattention risk function, I think, will be quite useful for a variety of applications that I'll talk about at the end. But if you've been following the news in terms of driver distraction and NHTSA's intervention with guidelines, I think it will be particularly useful there. So what we're interested in is how looking away contributes or causes crashes. And there's a couple different perspectives you could take, a couple entry points into this problem. One is to look at activities, cell phone conversations, text messaging, and so on. Or you can look at the behaviors. And what we'll be looking at is those proximal causes, the behaviors, rather than the distal causes, the activities. One rationale for that is that those proximal causes are more generic, more generalizable. If we understand how behaviors contribute to consequences, we'll be able to write good generic guidelines to designers in terms of how you have to manage the display to minimize glances away from the road. So what we're really doing is looking at how looking behavior, looking towards the road away from it, contributes to crashes and near crashes. Looking at how behaviors relate to consequences. And this is an illustration of that. The device on the right is a metronome. The idea there is that if you have a metronome in your mind that guides your glances to the road and away from the road, and you're synced to that metronome that minimizes the long glances away from the road, you may be able to safely multitask, minimizing those long, dangerous glances. So that's the idea. Shown in a different way is in terms of glance durations across the bottom and then frequency on the vertical. You have this distribution of glance durations. The blue distribution may be very dangerous. The black distribution may be safe. And what we want to do is push people to that safe distribution. This project will estimate what is that safe distribution, if there is one. So we want to identify what is an unsafe glance distribution and then ultimately help the designers design for that safe distribution. The sub-questions, the specific issues that we're addressing is inattention, coming up with a metric of inattention in terms of single glances and then the glance history, looking at inopportune glances, which I'll describe in a moment in particular, and then in terms of glance history, the intensity and duration of that glance history. Risk, looking at the severity of the potential crash as well as its likelihood or proximity. This is building upon some of the work in the 100-car study where they just had crash, no crash. Some of those crashes were curb strikes where you bump the curb with your tire as opposed to actual contact with another vehicle. We're going to delineate that range of severity more specifically. The timing refers to the context of the event. In specifics, we're looking at the timing of the onset and the degree of salience of the onset of the precipitating event, the event that triggers the response, so the braking of the lead vehicle. When did that occur? How salient was it? And then finally, the question that all this leads to is how can we contribute to solving the distraction problem through countermeasures? So this is a graph that shows some of our initial thinking and work to quantify inattention. The graph there with the red and blue lines, I think, is particularly important, illustrating two contributions to distraction. One is, in the red, the glance history. So over time, if you're looking away from the road a lot, if you're reading Tolstoy as you're driving, so you're looking away from the road over an extended period of time, your distraction gets worse and worse, indicated by the downward slope. And then for each glance to Tolstoy, to the book as you're driving, you get that blue component, the acute decrease in your attention to the road. And so the question is, which of those factors is important? And there's a paper that was written by a graduate student of mine, Yulan Lang, published in Human Factors just a couple months ago, that quantifies or uses a number of algorithms to quantify this relationship. And what she found is essentially it's just the blue stuff. This is research sponsored by NHTSA and done with the 100-car study data. So that's an initial answer there. And I've been doing some follow-up work that shows this issue of the overlapping or inopportune glance, inopportune in the sense that it overlaps the precipitating event. And it turns out that that overlapping glance dominates the risk function. So that 1.2 second glance towards the end of the timeline, that's the really risky thing. Okay, that's what we're doing in terms of quantifying inattention. Risk, what we're looking at here is defining risk in terms of the severity measure, which is a function of the safety margin, time to collision in the sense of incursion on the lead vehicle, and then the injury risk in terms of the differential masses of the two vehicles and the delta V potential at impact. So that's what we're doing with risk. And then the timing, what we're looking at is this inopportune glance associated with the timing of a more or less salient event on the road. And the idea is that you would have highest likelihood of a crash where you have an inopportune glance paired with a not very salient cue, and that would of the collision, and that would in this case be a salient one. You have a big object that's looming, salient. A less salient object might be a motorcycle that's braking slowly. So we're looking at that timing component and how that affects the risk and likelihood of crash. So the bottom line in terms of countermeasures, we think the results will be very useful for a variety of things ranging from regulation and policy in terms of cell phone regulation, design in terms of input to performance guidelines, design guidelines, in terms of feedback to drivers, in-vehicle feedback where you can actually build in the metronome that might help drivers manage their glances to and away from the road. And then in terms of intervention, having active safety systems know the state of the driver, know the state of inattention of the driver and compensate. And then the last one on the far right there is information and training, where we would use this as a behavioral-based interventions in the sense of coaching people towards safer driving. So with that, thank you for your attention and any questions. I can't answer a couple questions. I was just joking about having you guys answer. Okay.
Thank you, John. We'll move into session two and of this afternoon, and now we turn into a working session. So
you are all part of the workers.
Consider this, that you are all potential users of these data. You've seen examples from our four contractors up here who are the guinea pigs, because they've already formulated their research questions and they've started working with things like this. But think of this, that you are a potential user. You want to get at these data. You want to get your research question addressed with them. There are two big hurdles you have to jump through, which have been alluded to by the speakers so far. The first is dealing with the privacy issues, the institutional review boards, the data access agreements, and working with the two contractors, Virginia Tech and C-Tree, to resolve these. The second is actually getting at a data set and starting to work with this. And we're going to address these in two separate sessions. First session is the IRB session. And the data access session, what do you need to satisfy and how do you do it? And how much fun have these four people had in dealing with these issues? And this is very much intended to be a back and forth question answer part. We'll start off with a brief presentation by Ann Brock, the director of SHARP, who will give you an overview of these issues from the NAS perspective. Then we'll hear from Susie Lee and Miguel Perez from Virginia Tech and Omar Smadi from C-Tree about how do they, as their stewards of the data, work with you as requesters. Then we'll have each of the four contractors speak in turn about how much fun they've had dealing with these over the last several months.
And that should, I hope, generate a lot of questions. So, Ann, you're first up.
Thank you. Okay, as Jim said, I was asked to talk about the IRB issues from the National Academy of Sciences, TRB perspective. We use so many different titles and acronyms for ourselves. I might say National Academy of Sciences, National Research Council, or TRB for the specific differences at certain points, but it's us, basically. Basically, we have two objectives. And the first is, of course, to protect the human subjects in the research, and in particular, after the research, after the data collection is over, this is really about ensuring the confidentiality of the data, that people's identities don't get out, they don't have video on YouTube and stuff like that. But at the same time, we want to make the data available to researchers. And when I say the data, I mean all of the data. We want researchers who have a good reason to use any part of the data to have a way of getting at it, even if it is the face data, face video, for example. And these are interests that are not just a concern for SHARP II. This has been something that the National Research Council has been very concerned about beyond SHARP II and prior to SHARP II, is making sure that especially publicly funded data are made accessible to researchers, and that personally identifying information is protected. I actually, to prepare for this, I went to our National Academies Press website and just Googled data access, and almost 2,000 reports and workshop proceedings and such came up, the first 30 of which, the only ones I looked at, 21 of them are directly about making data available, and of those, 7 are directly about protecting personally identifying data. And most of those were in the last 12 years. So there's been at least one report from this institution a year for the last dozen years on this issue. So we really care about this a lot. The specific role of the National Academy's IRB was one of the things I was asked to address. And their role differs depending upon the stage that we're at in this whole process. They've had a very, very active and important role during the actual conduct of the data collection. I think earlier today, you've heard different numbers. You've heard 6 IRBs, but I think earlier today, Bob Skinner actually referred to the 8 IRBs. There were 8 IRBs involved. 8 IRBs reviewed the original protocol and the consent form, and all of their concerns had to be dealt with. Subsequently, 2 of them authorized Virginia Tech's IRB to act in their stead, which is why we only have 6 that had to go through all the amendment processes. But 8 different groups looked at all of this material. The National Academy's IRB is basically the final word. Until they say it's okay, we can't spend the money to actually collect the data. So they have been extremely involved in general oversight and all approvals. And, of course, their main concerns were things like making sure that the subjects really knew what we were going to be doing, what's going to be in their vehicle, what kind of data are being collected, how would they be protected, how would they be used, and what were the legal risks that they may be, or any other risks, but in particular it was legal risks, that they may be exposed to. The typical stuff that an IRB is supposed to be concerned about. Interestingly, though, at the beginning, they really were not concerned about driving safety. And then somehow in the middle of everything, one person got a bee in her bonnet that we needed to prove that the study was not making people less safe in their driving, which it is not. We did that little study. Okay. During data use, our IRB has agreed that they are not going to review all of the requested uses of the data. That would be unbearable for everyone, including us. So what they've done is they've agreed to a process, which Susie will give you more details about. And as long as we follow that process, which involves the research institution's IRB, then our IRB does not have to get involved. I just have to make sure I keep all the paperwork so that if they ask me questions, I can tell them exactly how the data are being used and that everyone got their, you know, IRB approvals and things like that. As far as how the academies would be involved after the SHARP II program is over, that depends upon what the decisions are in terms of long-term stewardship of the data. It could range from being the very same role that it has now to having no role whatsoever. So that I can't answer right now. So what are some of the things that the National Academies or National Research Council has done to ensure that data would be accessible? Well, the tools that the institution has are few, but I think we use them very well. For one thing, we made sure that in the contracts of all anyone who's working on this project, that it's clear that the data are to be accessible to other researchers. There's no language in any of the contracts that could constrain the future use of the data beyond what the IRB restrictions are. We also made sure that we didn't mix any other funds in with SHARP II funds. Not that anyone offered, but we had a policy to make sure that it was clear that we were the ones paying for every bit of the data, so one set of rules applies. We don't have to worry about other sets of rules. Of course, they reviewed the consent language, and I will show you a little bit of the consent language. And we've also tried to be very vigilant against having any additional constraints creep in. And this has been mostly with the roadway data. We really don't want the roadway database to be saddled with different constraints from different states that gave us different data. It would make it impossible to manage. So we've been trying to make sure that the data that are in that database all have the same set of rules as well. And then the second thing we decided to do within TRB and, SHARP II and the Oversight Committee was to make sure that we did start funding use of the data before we're finished collecting it. We need to start demonstrating that it can be used and getting the lessons learned so that we can make improvements. And that's the four projects that you just heard about. We had actually intended to fund more, but we decided as a strategic decision with limited funds that we took some of the analysis funds aside, and they're going to be made available to disseminate data, to do some of these reduced data sets, and to provide user support in hopes that people from outside will come in with their ideas and their money to use the data, and we can fund helping them to do that. It was a better leveraging of the money we had rather than, you know, to say to pay for two more SO8s. We might be able to support 10 or 15 more studies. So that's one decision that was made. And of course, again, all the things that have to do with the future will depend upon what kind of decisions are made by others. We actually know now what Congress decided to do, which is they didn't put specific money on supporting this database, but there is the potential of money available that would support the implementation of the database. Okay. All right, consent form. These are the things that are in the participant consent form that deal with after the data collection. There's a ton that's in there about what's happening during data collection. But after data collection, these are the things they know are going to happen. The data will be housed in at least one secure facility, Virginia Tech's, and possibly others. We specifically mentioned the Department of Transportation because at the time we thought they might actually become the owners. But no further specification than that, just that there may be other sites in the plural. That other qualified researchers would be given access under a data sharing agreement and IRB review and approval. That's purposely vague or general, qualified researcher, because we didn't know at the time what we were going to mean by qualified researcher, and that could change over time, and it could depend upon what kind of research you're doing or what level of security you have within your own facility to take in some of the data. So we kept that as broad as we could, but the one thing is it will be used for research. It's not going to be used for things that are not research. That they are guaranteed that the level of security of the data will always be at least what it is now. It will never be less secure, or personally identifying information is never going to be made public, that kind of thing. Researchers can use the personally identifying data if they need to for their research, but they can't copy that data and bring that home. They'd need to have some kind of reduced data set or some kind of derived data that they could bring home with them, but we can't have people's face video on lots of people's laptops. And if you do need to show face video for a conference or something, that the face has to be de-identified and no other information can be put together with it that would allow somebody in the room to figure out who the participants were. And they are explicitly told that they are consenting to other research uses. for up to 30 years. So that's what the users know, the participants know about the data. And that is all specifically not specific. It was on purpose that we did not want the language to be tied to particular kinds of research. It's not tied to safety research. If planning and operations people think they can use this data for their kind of issues, I've had somebody from MIT who wanted to do some psychological research using the face data. That's okay as long as it's research. So we didn't constrain the topics of the research, and we did not want to tie any access things to specific methods, technologies, or any of that, because those things are going to change. We may find that there are new threats to protecting the data or new opportunities to protect it, new ways of sharing it. So we tried to make sure that we were not tying our hands unnecessarily. And one of the reasons I want to say that is when we talk about how data are available right now, that's the way they're available right now. They're only at Virginia Tech. We're not opening up other sites right now. We don't have the funds within SHARP 2 to do that. And I insisted that we be very conservative about following the rules because we're just starting and we cannot afford to have any data spill or any kind of mistake. But it is possible that methods and policies would evolve with time and experience. And if there's a lot of demand for the data, there could be many locations that people could see the personally identifying data, for example. So anyway, a lot of that stuff depends on resources. And now you'll hear the nuts and bolts. Yes. All of the data. They consented.
Oh, all the data is for 30 years. Well, I'm sorry, I thought you said three.
No. It's actually, there are always more nuances behind PowerPoints, right? There are certain data that we will keep for 30 years, and that's the personally identifying data. And then there's Susie knows the details. There's some that we can keep for 40 years, and stuff that there's absolutely no way you can identify people could be kept indefinitely.
Okay, but if we wanted to use the videos, but the videos themselves are long like that as well.
That's the 30-year.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions on the big picture? I see one.
Yeah.
So some of the SO8 contractors need to look at the face video to do their analysis. Now, are they going to have to go to the secure data enclave to do that analysis?
Sit over there and we start. Or
sure. Hang on. That will be addressed very shortly.
Any other general ones?
Just for the audience's benefit, to give a very high-level overview of what constitutes PII besides the video.
Is that? Are you going to be talking about that? Well, they'll have to all. The experts here will correct me, but generally, the face data is personally identifying. The GPS we're considering personally identifying. If you had full GPS traces, you can find out who people are. And there is a button you can push to record the voice for 30 seconds. The driver can do that if they want to record something. That we're considering to be personally identifying, although you could have a transcript made and, you know, take names out of it or something. But if it's the actual voice, we consider that personally identifying. That's the easy part. The difficult part is a category of data that are potentially identifying depending upon how you sample them or what other data from outside you might connect them with in your research. That's the really hard part. So.
And just to tag on a couple of interesting comments, something that you've pointed out from the beginning. And this goes to the complexity of the stewardship and ownership. In general terms, the federal government has no legal basis for saying that one person using the data can be preferred over another. Doesn't matter what the definition of a researcher, qualified researcher is. In general terms, the federal government cannot say, Miguel gets to use it and you don't. There are workarounds, depending on contracting mechanisms, but that's just a part of what the Volpe team has been trying to balance as they come up with options.
Yeah. because that's untenable. We have to be able to be make distinctions. So, is that it? Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Let me introduce Susie Lee, part of the Virginia Tech team, who will tell you the nuts and bolts of how this really works. You're a researcher. You want access to these data. What do you do?
And I'm going to be speaking about basically how you form these data sharing agreements. And then the real nuts and bolts is where Miguel Perez and some other folks come in terms of how you actually get the data to where you're going to be using it. So data access, as we keep hearing today, that is the end goal. That's everybody's end goal. It won't have been worth a darn if we've gone through this whole thing and people don't or can't, for whatever reason, use the data. So again, data will be held for up to 40 years with 30 years for the personally identifying information. The type of data that will exist forever will be some of these reduced data sets or summary data sets and things like that will probably be publicly available on the internet, and there's not going to be any reason to ever take those down or not let people still use those. The time series data, for example, is the data that will be held for up to 40 years, but data that are reduced out of that can be held indefinitely. At present, the current protocol is that researchers can obtain access to the SHARP-2 NDS data through VTTI. Again, we keep hearing this may not be how it works in the future, but for right now, if you've got a research question and you want to obtain access to the data, this is what you would have to do today. You'd have to have some sort of a contract and funds to support the data preparation. As you'll hear as we go on through the afternoon, you'll get a deeper understanding of what's involved with that. You'll need IRB approval of some sort. I'll talk about that more in a minute, and a data sharing agreement. You'll need, currently, you'll need SHARP-2 approval for non-SHARP-2 projects. They kind of need to know how the data are being used, and we're tracking all of these data requests and providing information to SHARP-2, and when we get a signed data sharing agreement, we also pass that on to SHARP-2 for their records. Currently, identifying video and full GPS traces have to be viewed at the VTTI Secure Data Enclave. And typically, that's the face video. Non-identifying data can be shipped out. A data sharing agreement is basically an agreement between the data steward and the research team, and the research team is agreeing to certain things by signing this, things like they're agreeing that they will not attempt to identify participants by combining information or manipulating the data that they receive in order to try to identify an individual persons who participated. It formalizes that the data will be shared and used in accordance with the promises made to the participants and the informed consent. So this is all about making sure that we keep these promises. We would not have this data set if it wasn't for these participants who were nice enough to allow us to instrument their vehicles, collect their data at a certain level of inconvenience to them. The data sharing agreement itself is currently, the nuts and bolts of it is about a 3-4 page document. It requires you to present a scope of analysis, exactly what you plan to do with your analysis, to specify the data set in some level of detail, although somebody like Miguel may then require a very detailed data specification that you'll go back and forth on to make sure before we prepare it that it's the correct data set to make the most efficient use of time and resources. You'll need IRB approval or proof of exemption, and I'll spend a couple of seconds talking about that. Non-identifying data, so let's say you just want a trip trace of speed and front radar range, and you don't want any video, you don't want any GPS, and it's just these two streams of data, that would be very non-identifying. It'd be very difficult to figure out, who that person was that where all these data were being collected. So there's a category of IRB approval called exempt, and some IRBs will just send you an email saying they've reviewed what you're going to get, and it falls into this exempt category. whereas other IRBs actually have a formal category they call exempt, and they'll send you an approval letter saying this is exempt. We need one or the other, or if it's identifying, then you'll need a higher level of IRB approval. All of the researchers who are going to be handling and using this data, receiving it, need to undergo human subjects training, which is typically an online training course that can take from, depending on where you take it, from 45 minutes to an hour and a half. And it basically grounds you in the principles of human subjects protection and makes you aware of, you know, why it is that we are protecting these participants. A lot of people come from a background where they haven't dealt with human participants before, civil engineering or certain other things, and they really can't understand why can't you ship me a DVD with a face video, and why can't you do this, and why can't you do that? And so there's an education process that goes on. A lot of times there'll be emails back and forth explaining some of these things in addition to the training. And then there's a time frame for data retention. Typically it's a certain amount of time after the final reports are put out and everything, and you hold on to the data for a certain amount of time in case you need to reanalyze it or something to answer some questions that come up. And then at some point, the data get either returned back into the main database for other people to use, or if it's proprietary, we just ask that it be destroyed at that point. It cannot be used for other projects without additional IRB approval is the reason that you do that. The temptation is that if a data set sits in some sort of a server and it's accessible to a few people and a new research question comes up, the temptation is to go ahead and start using this data to answer another research question, but you haven't received IRB approval for that. There's no data sharing agreement for that. And that's why we have this data retention clause in there to try to keep everybody on their toes, especially as time goes on. At present, so these are some of the lessons learned from VTTI's perspective. At present, while SHARP 2 is ongoing, SHARP 2 must approve all non-SHARP 2 data requests. The data sharing agreement process may require some back and forth negotiation. Sometimes this is a two-stage process. Sometimes an IRB actually wants to see the data sharing agreement partially executed before they will grant approval. And then at that point, it'll come back, and then we'll go ahead and do the final signatures on that DSA. And then, you know, this sounds like a complex process, and it's really, in most cases, not that bad, and it's getting faster as time goes on. But then you get on to the data extraction, the data preparation, the data transfer, and that's when it all adds up to patients. When you add all of these things together, it's not an instantaneous process. There's not a folder sitting on Miguel's, you know, desktop with data sets ready to hand out. Every one takes some preparation and some thinking. So currently, a lot of patients, the process is already becoming more streamlined, and it should become more streamlined into the future. And I'm always available to take phone calls and email inquiries about the process.
If a reduced data set is created from review of data, would that then be available for other researchers who go through the process?
That's the intent, and that is a clause in the data sharing agreements, I think, in just about all of them that we've signed to date. You can run into situations where people might want to develop a proprietary algorithm, and so that clause can be modified, and it might say something like the data set will be, you kind of quarantine for 5 years or something before it's put into the general data set to kind of account for certain uses like that, where somebody's developing a proprietary algorithm. It's their own intellectual property. They're using the data set to develop their own intellectual property. And so that's a case where that might come into play. And I don't think we've had a case like that yet.
Paul, and then back here.
I'm curious about what you said about GPS only being viewed at Virginia Tech. I mean, can you say a little bit more about the GPS traces and
the complete
how
trace,
accurate they are at the beginning and at the end of the trip?
Yeah, the complete traces are considered personally identifying, because if you have on a day-to-day basis where somebody starts their trips and where they end their trips, you know where they live and where they work, and So even if, say, it takes a couple of minutes for GPS to really kick in, and they leave their house in the morning, they get to work, well, you know where they work because you get a really good GPS coordinate at the end of the trip, and then they go home, and maybe it takes a couple of minutes to kick in, but now you know where they end up in the evening, so you do end up with all of those personally identifying locations, and so that's why the endpoints are considered to be personally identifying. You still need to be careful with the whole trips. You can't just hand them out willy-nilly, but the endpoints are especially sensitive, and the rest of the stuff you have to think about carefully, and wherever you can, it's best to aggregate it, put more than one person together, put several trips together and things like that, so that it's not necessarily individual trips. But, of course, at times you do need to do things like left-hand turns. So in that case, do you really need the full trip, or can you take a 10-second epic that's around this left-hand turn? That's probably, in most cases, not going to be too troublesome, unless it's turning into a small business every day and there's only 5 employees who work there or something. So.
Let me just do one quick follow-up then. But, I mean, you could construct a scenario where somebody would be interested in observing, I don't know, out of the several thousand people in the study, let's say a handful, a couple of dozen, who repeatedly go over the same route all the time. So is what you're saying, does that eliminate that as a possibility? I understand about the endpoints, but one could certainly want to study driver behavior over the same section of road multiple times. So that, I guess that's what I'm trying to get at.
Yeah.
The problem, Paul, is that we don't have enough experience to give an intelligent answer. Our starting point is that the GPS is potentially personally identifying because we can imagine situations where that would be the case. At the same time, we also think that for many applications of the GPS data, when you get to the specific application, it will be easy to come up with a way where its use can be allowed in a way that will support the analysis and not have any personally identifying, any potential to reveal identity. We just don't know enough yet to say in general terms exactly what the answer to that is. We think that probably once we've worked through half a dozen or a dozen uses of GPS, we could say something that would be a lot more informative about, well, if you do A, B, and C, there's not any problem, but you can't do D, E, and F. But I just don't know enough to give a reasonable description of those.
That's
so,
one of the reasons.
So it'll be made available. We just have to think about it first.
That's one of the reasons I wanted to emphasize that the specific policies and procedures that we have right now are not necessarily going to be the same ones for 30 years. We have to get experience and hopefully be able to do things more easily with time.
I was wondering about how, if people are giving the data back after they've worked with it, are there plans in terms of how you're going to integrate that back into the data set? Are you like literally going to kind of build this out? Or is that going to be like a separate subset? So I read a paper, and this is an interesting paper, and so I would like to do some additional analyses on that type of research, what they did. And as sort of an additional related question, are there going to be any kind of like coding conventions or things that you're going to put in place so when people take stuff, they're going to use some kind of convention so as people are doing this back and forth and building out the data set, we don't have things done in 100 different ways?
I'll take a stab at it. Let's start with the conventions just because it was the last thing to mention. There are no specific plans to force people to do things a certain way. I think as a researcher, and there's plenty in this room, none of us really end up doing things the same way. So I think each particular research question is going to have different nuances. And while we are happy to tell people and let people know what others have done in the past and leverage off of that, we can't really force anybody to do things a certain way. So beyond really just saying understanding what somebody's asking and saying, well, you know, so-and-so did this way, and that reduction has been created. And therefore, if you want to do something similar, it's a little easier to do it that way. Beyond doing that, I don't think I can do much more. The data set itself, the time series data, is will be standardized in that there's a set of standard variables, and that will not change. As far as your earlier question, and I guess we're getting it a little bit into the process here, but for example, for each of the SO8s, when they request, right now the requests have been trip segments, so it hasn't even been a whole trip, but each of those trip segments is coded in our database or in the SHARP2 database. I feel like it's a little bit of my baby in some ways, so I'm a little possessive. But those events are coded in the database with a unique event ID, so which the SO8s get. So Shauna's events, the files she has have an event ID associated with them, and with that event ID, we can tie the trip segment that she has back to the main database. And any reduction or any additional information that she gets on those events, when it comes back, it would be tied back to that event ID. So that's what ties everything together, in a way. As far as how that gets put out in the website, that's still very much an open question. It just depends on what the database is.
Just a quick follow-up. Then if people are providing the data back, will there at least be some kind of requirements in terms of reporting back to whoever's the steward of the database, data dictionaries, exactly how they're defining things? So, I mean, one person names something the same person, some other person names something the same way, but they define it differently so that the follow-up researcher knows exactly what it is they're looking
yes.
at.
Yeah, that's very much when a data set leaves the database, it goes along with the data dictionary. I would expect that the same would come back. So essentially, there'd be some definition of what it's coming back, and it's not going to be I wouldn't expect it to be just that anybody can post these things. It's going to be whoever the steward is and whoever has that role will have some kind of, I guess, veto power, for lack of a better word, or somebody's going to have some decision making to do in terms of what goes in there, making sure that whatever gets put in there has filled some level of quality standards that you're alluding to.
Follow up to that. Right now, we're a little bit in the wild west of SHARP2 naturalistic driving data, and TRB just happens to be the sheriff right now. But one could imagine, as civilization develops, that there would be better mechanisms for doing these. I imagine there being user groups and, you know, people who get together regularly like this and hash out some of these questions and develop consensus, or not. There could be a lot of different ways of doing things. But you could imagine that this could actually become something quite substantial. Could be, you know, Manhattan instead of the Wild West.
My question goes back to the personal identifying information. I have a question about how crashes will be handled, which are identifiable with date and time and location.
So severe crashes, those that are police reportable and may have ended up in the newspaper, for example, you can do things like, instead of saying it happened on January 26th, 2012, you can say that it happened in the month of January on a Monday at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, or between 3 and 6 in the afternoon, or something like that. So there are ways to de-identify crash data, to kind of blur it, so to speak, but still make it useful to the researcher.
But if you're linking it with other data sets that are important to get date and time, those will be linked someplace else? And then,
well, for example, this morning there were talks about linking climatological data, things like that. So that would have to be on a case-by-case basis, as so many things that we've talked about today. But you do need to be very careful about potentially identifying crash data.
I think another thing that needs to be clarified is that it could be possible that you, the researcher, need to have that information to make the linkage, but then you don't keep that information. you do your analysis, you publish your analysis, but you don't publish the date and the time, that sort of thing.
Okay, perfect.
And at the same time that you've signed the data sharing agreement as a researcher, you are, by signing that, you're agreeing not to try to identify, so you're agreeing not to go to the newspapers or police accident reports that may be publicly available and trying to identify who that is so you can go interview them or something. And that's part of the Wild West, and we'll send Sheriff Ann after you.
Can you please explain the logic behind data being expired? Because at least except PII information that could identify the participants, the rest of the data, if you could distribute it in a second to everybody that wants it, you would, wouldn't you? But if you have distributed, send it some part of data to somebody, and they could use it further beyond what they have been planning to, what's the harm in that? I don't understand that.
It's human subjects data. So if you're not familiar with that, it falls under a whole set of laws and regulations and ethical guidelines, and it needs to undergo IRB approval anytime you do data mining on it or start a new research project on it. And so let's say that you've got a consecutive project that needs the same data set. Your data sharing agreement may be that you're not going to destroy the data or ship it back, but you sign a new data sharing agreement and have additional IRB approval, and you say we're going to use the same data set and keep it for another 2 years or whatever it is, and do this additional analysis.
Some unnecessary bureaucratic bumps into this process by this? If data is there and people are using it.
There's a whole history to this that comes more out of the medical research side, and a lot of concerns about people's data being used in ways that they hadn't intended or didn't know. It's basically a question of protecting the ethical aspect of this, and it's not really a big deal, I think, to sign a second data sharing agreement. Once you've signed one, your organization has agreed to everything that's in it. All you're doing is saying, now I want to do it for this study, and my IRB said I could do it. I don't think it's going to be that big a deal, right?
In our experience so far, the getting the data sharing agreement and the IRB approval is not the real bottlenecks. And sometimes they may feel like they are until you reach the next one. But
many people think that the IRB regulations are overkill, particularly when they're in this kind of research. But we don't get to decide that. That's, you know, beyond us.
Real bottleneck after the break.
Yeah. This is the promise that we've made with our participants in the consent forms, and we're going to hold to those promises.
Well, and I just wanted to say real quick, coming from a university setting and a hospital setting, one of the unfortunate natures of human subject research, you renew your IRB every year anyway. You go through a bureaucratic thing every 12 months anyway, just for the IRB to know what's going on. So when you come up to that next year, you just change your data sharing agreement and expand it. It's not a one-time thing, unfortunately. So it shouldn't be that big of a deal to add on another research question.
I got two questions here. One is, how many non-SHOP2 projects has requested data from you guys so far? And what's the length of time to process these data? Also, hearing the discussion, I guess one comment I have is, even though you can't really force a researcher to organize the data in a certain way, I think you can certainly encourage the people to document, you know, how they process data, what they do, because I think that's very important. A lot of times we're getting data, and if, you know, we're getting these reduced data, but if you don't know the history, how the data is being reduced, a lot of times you are just really playing with data that you don't have a lot of knowledge about. So I think that it's important too, as we're sharing data, we can encourage the researcher that they need to document the information and stuff like that. Really, that will help us, the entire research community, to advance on how to use the SHARP2 data. So,
Ken, why don't you take the first one? How many non-SHARP2 requests?
It's numbers I can count on my fingers. I'm not sure. It's somewhere between 4 and 6.
Um,
I am in possession of 7 executed data sharing agreements, 2 with Omar, 1 for each of the SO8s, and 1 for another researcher at Virginia Tech, because they have to go through the same process.
I thought the question was non-sharp, and B, I thought it was requests, not data sharing agreements.
All right. I thought you were answering the bigger question, but the only non-sharp one that I'm aware of is another Virginia Tech researcher.
There are
others asking.
Half a dozen other serious inquiries that have been talking to Ken or talking to Virginia Tech or talking to Omar. Second piece of that dealt with documentation and so forth. Miguel, you want to take that one?
Sure. I'm happy to encourage people to do certain things, but at some point, I can't tell people how to do the research. So point taken, very much taken. I think it's an important thing, but my role is not to be quality control for other researchers. I don't feel like I have any authority to do that. So I can certainly suggest, but that's the extent of what I can do.
Take a short intermission from questions. Hold the questions. We'll come back. But I would like to first ask Omar from CITRI to talk very briefly about how this personal identifying issue and data sharing agreements affect CITRI in their roadway data. And then I'd like to ask each of the 4 SO8s to talk very briefly about how much fun they've had going through this process over the past several months. Okay, Omar, you're first.
Okay, so from our perspective in terms of CITRI, we've dealt with this at 2 different levels. The first level is we actually requested data from VTTI, which meant we have to have a data sharing agreement with VTTI for the GPS traces that we use for routing and also for the GPS points that we're going to use to test how we link the data set. So we had to sign a data sharing agreement and go to our IRB at Iowa State. In both cases, our IRB said we're exempt from a review because we have de-identified data. We don't have PII data, which was a very easy process at Iowa State. It's basically just an email back to us. We send to VTTI, and then that gets our data sharing agreement approved, and we get the data. The other side of it is, of course, the roadway information data that we're collecting, the existing data from the state DOTs and the supplemental data that we have. And all of that data is not, basically has no identification in it. So there is no IRB process required for any researcher to get the roadway information. And as Ann said, we've insisted when we worked with agencies like the DOTs that there are no data sharing agreements when they provide us data. That data is available to everybody who is interested in doing research and requesting that roadway information database. So if you're requesting just roadway data, no issues with, we will not require a data sharing agreement or an IRB unless SHARP2 would require that. So pretty straightforward, pretty simple. When we worked with the SO8s, we did not provide them data from VTTI until they signed a data sharing agreement with VTTI. Then we made those maps and the GPS traces that Shauna and Karen talked about available to them after they signed that data sharing agreement.
Good.
Pretty straightforward.
Yep. But let's go down the line. Gary, how much fun have you had working on these issues? Push the button on the mic.
Okay, our contract was signed on January 27th. We were told it was signed by the University of Minnesota on February 5th. It took about 2 weeks to verify that we'd all had the appropriate human subjects training, and then I wrote up the IRB application and had some people review it. Okay, we finally sent it to the University of Minnesota's IRB about the 1st of March, and they approved it in 2 weeks, which is pretty short, okay, for an IRB approval. And we managed to get exempt, okay, status, even though we were going to go in and look at the face video. I thought I was all done at that point, okay, and sent the data request to Miguel, okay, and he came back and said, no, you need a data sharing agreement. All right, so that took a while, okay, to work that through as well here. But Susie was really good about making sure that it got through as quickly as could possibly be done here. So it was around the 1st of May, okay, before all the paperwork was in place, okay, and we could legitimately actually have some data here. So around about 2 months to get through that process. Okay. One last comment. Okay, there was a question about date and time. We're looking at freeways, and we're looking at congested freeways, okay? The Washington DOT has a very good extensive database on loop detector information, and we wanted to link with that. Currently, there's no easy way to do that, okay, because you need to know date and time, and providing date and time is apparently a violation, okay, of the consent agreement, okay, that the participants solved. All right, and so that's something to be thought about, okay, as a way to work through that.
Shauna?
So we had a similar timeline with, as Gary had, as far as we started, as soon as we got the ink on the contract was drying about getting all our pieces. I think it's helpful when you work at a university because most universities have IRB processes in place. And so it's sort of, even if you haven't done it yourself, it's sort of known. Somebody knows how to go about doing that. It might be harder for a private consultant that has never done an IRB. Not all have developed that yet. I don't think MRI had an internal IRB process, right? You did have that, okay. But it was fairly simple to get through that. So getting through that was not terribly onerous because we had done it before, and it was really fairly easy to work with VTTI and get all the pieces in place. I think what got a little more difficult was when we actually got to what we're going to request and how we're going to get to it. So we realized that ideally we thought that the VTTI data would, their NDS data would be linked with the roadway data, and we could say something like, can you give us all curves that are 500 meters and have one instance of a lane departure? Well, the data have not yet been linked, and so that was not possible. So we realized with the burden that was on both of Iowa State and VTTI to get roadway and the NDS data that we would try to simplify it for them. So we got the VTTI trip files, and we actually identified ourselves curves. We did one state. We did Florida to start with because they had the most advanced data collection. We picked curves ourselves, and we drew a buffer and similar to what Karen did. And then we said back to Miguel, here's a buffer that you can use to search. And I think that probably made things go a lot faster because we knew what we wanted and they didn't have to do any of that. So I think that was helpful. We also made a trip out to Virginia Tech right after we had got our request done. That was incredibly helpful because we were able to sit and talk and Miguel pulled up traces and we were able to see what was going on. And so that was another thing that was incredibly helpful to us. One thing that I think is potentially bottlenecking for us is when we made the initial data crest, I think Miguel identified 1,000 trips, and then he asked us to pare that down to 500 to start with. And then the snafu that came up was that we can't use unconsented driver. We can't even look at it. We'd ideally wanted them just to run the data, give us all the raw data. We'll go through and decide if trips don't make sense, and then we'll ask you to come to the enclave and look at face video for a reduced set. But unfortunately, we cannot look at the unconsented driver. So I believe Virginia Tech, and maybe Miguel could answer that better, has to open every trace file and look at the driver face.
We'll get into that a little bit
later. Okay, yeah.
Let's just deal with the PII and the IRB and the data access agreements at this point.
Yeah. Okay. So that was the biggest snafu for us.
Okay. John?
So 3 points on IRB. The first one, as we've mentioned, IRB is essential for this sort of work and might be surprising to some of you who haven't dealt with it. And one of the main reasons for that, I think, is that truly de-identifying data is very, very difficult. Netflix, a couple years ago, had a prize for improving their algorithm to predict desired films, or rating of film. And some clever data scientist was able to de-identify those data, even though they were just, I think, ratings of films, and that's it. So de-identifying data is difficult. So if your IRB asks questions, bear with them, be attentive to the issue. Confidentiality is really critically important, as we've said. Second point, one of the things that we found useful in this project is using the medical database as a model. So some universities, some IRBs, are familiar with dealing with de-identified data in medical health databases. And if you use that as an analogy for what we're doing here, that might facilitate some of the questions that you might get back from the IRB. It might give them a model to think about what we're doing that is close and might help the process. At least we found it to help for us. The last point with respect to IRB considerations is that the data request and the IRB process are coupled. So you need to be thinking very carefully about what data you need as you're writing up the IRB request. This is very different than when you run a simulator experiment where you collect the data, and then you can go in and mine the data in all sorts of different ways, changing your variables as you like. Not the case with these data. The IRB process is very directly coupled to the data request. If you change your data request, you may have to change your IRB. So.
Good. And Karen.
I like that, you know, there's four of us, and I don't think there's any four alike. So from a statistician's point of view, I really like the random sampling here.
We like it, too, from the point of view of Sharp.
So it covers some bases. I mean, we had yet a different experience. We do have an IRB at MRI Global, and what you have to do is, for us, we didn't think that we needed to go through another IRB at Sharp 2, and so what we had to do is submit our work plan that all of us had to submit really early into the contract. And then I submitted the work plan to my IRB, and they decided that we are exempt. So then the next step was really what John just said is you really need to know which variables you need for your specific study. And it helps to actually have looked through this data dictionary of this data. And it's a big binder and has a lot of stuff in it, because ultimately I had to write down the variable and their names into my data sharing agreement on what I need for my study. So we had done that. And so there was some back and forth on for what we need, how do we get it? So there were conversations between Miguel and Omar. We had a few of those to narrow it down, come up with our list, send it to Miguel, fine-tune it a little bit, add this, take this out. Oh, by the way, you cannot have date and time and all of that that we just talked about, but more like a window. And so I thought I was kind of done, and we wrote our data sharing agreement. And then we were told that we had to go through this training. I didn't know about that. So all of us had to go take that course and then get our certificate. And it just, you know, basically we learned along the way. We didn't have the grocery list right up front. I kind of learned as I went along. So we finally put this data sharing agreement together. We all signed it. We submitted it. It was reviewed by VTTI. It was signed. And then we started our data process. Then a little later, we were told that we have all the right information in our data sharing agreement, but I didn't follow this questionnaire and I didn't know that existed. So it was back to redoing the data sharing agreement, basically cutting and pasting the various pieces into this questionnaire style of thing so Sharp 2 could review it in what they like to see it in. We had all the pieces and more, but it was not laid out the right way. So. And then we actually did get into this issue a lot that I hear here is, you know, we wanted to put in the data sharing agreement what we do with our reduced data, being researchers and making, say, presentations. We need to be in a situation where down the road, if somebody asks us, well, how did you do it? We need to be able to defend our research results, and therefore we want our reduced data to be kept at our location. And there were quite some discussions back and forth to just have the right language and in you know, just the right way. So that took some time. And then, you know, you have issues like people are traveling, and so it postpones. And so we managed to get the final data sharing agreement just at the end of last month. So like June 29th or something like that. But we had one in April, so, you know, it's a little difficult. But now we know. I think it was a learning experience for both sides, both MRI Global and VTTI, on how to go about that. So next time I do know that there is a format to follow. I just didn't know it.
Thank you. I had cut off some questions back in the back, so.
Thank you. One other question I had about like streamlining all the databases, you know, it seems that this is going to go back and forth in order to get the data, access to the data. Would it be possible, just like, you know, maybe I'm sure that the team is going to do this and come up some sort of data products so that people will use the data products, so reduce the cost and also make that products available. Everybody knows what kind of data items they're getting. And then, like, if you come up with something like for the researcher, the detail-oriented researcher, so they get really everything. And then for some people, maybe they're looking at, like, aggregate-level information, so they'll be able to get that, too. So just a comment.
The answer is yes, that's a definite possibility. Are there specific things defined yet? No. What we at Sharp would like to know is what you would like in this. The term of art is a reduced data set, something that's smaller than the huge amount of data that's going to be in the whole thing, that, if possible, removes a lot of the personally identifying so that one doesn't have to go through the IRB, but is still useful to do research on. If you have suggestions on those, send them to Mr. Campbell. I hope you all got this front and back handout that was out on the table. If you didn't, pick it up. It shows what is in the mill right now, what's coming out soon, and what's being considered under the specialized smaller files, reduced data sets, and so forth. Send in your ideas. Sue?
I'm wondering about personally identifiable information about other vehicles in the scene, both from the car and the road data. Has that been a concern? I can see other cars in your video log.
Susie, you want to take that one? Or?
It's that certainly has been a concern, and we've you can definitely see other cars and sometimes kind of tell what make and model and color it is and things like that. It's not easy to see the license plate numbers or identifying information about those other vehicles. A more common scenario might be that a pedestrian, you're stopped at a intersection, a pedestrian walks right in front of your windshield, and you can see who that is. So what the data sharing agreements have a clause that asks you that, let's say that we ship you a set of forward video that is considered off the top of the hat to be non-personally identifying, but if you come across any files that you see contain personally identifying information in a set like that, that you mark those out, send us that information back, and those data will be quarantined and not, you know, released to anyone else, and you won't use them in any way to identify anyone. So,
and this is more of a cautionary comment in this day of Facebook. I mean, we've had situations at the National Advanced Driving Simulator where our research participants had such a good time being in our study, they put it on their Facebook. Or in some cases, put it on our Facebook with the picture. You know, here I am doing your study. So we've had, and our IRB, quite frankly, they don't quite know what to do with it. Because, you know, we called them and said, do we need to take this down? And because it wasn't us who ratted them out. They're ratting themselves out. And so we went ahead and took it down because it was kid. They were underage. And we felt we needed to take it down. But I think that may come as the data start coming out. You know, you have some story on CNN, and then in the comment section, you know, Joe Blow might say, hey, that was me.
Yeah, we agree, and we were thinking about that as we were setting up the IRB aspects, and there's actually something in the consent form that says something like, we strongly encourage you to protect the fact of your participation the same way you would protect other person, you know, sensitive information such as your bank account and different things, and we encourage you not to share it on social media sites and things like that. So that's about all you can do. And so far, I don't think we've run into an issue with
it. It's worth pointing out again that when the data are collected, they're totally encrypted. and they're totally encrypted all the way to Virginia Tech so that nobody can get at them at that point. Monique, and then back here.
Yeah, I think, you know, universities obviously have more experience dealing with IRBs, and some private research firms to some extent have them. But there's probably a large group of individuals who potentially have interest in this that don't have that experience. And from just listening to those of you who have done this before for other things, it sounds like each of you learned quite a bit and identified some best practices, if you will, in the process of going through that. I'm thinking, do you think there's value in helping those who come after you who need to deal with this, who may not have access and the history that you do, to maybe share some of those best practices for how to structure these and maybe how to shop around for IRB for hire?
I'll respond to that and finger a person in the audience. I believe Dan McGehee organized a workshop at TRB on exactly that topic, focused on naturalistic driving, I believe. So he's done a lot of work addressing exactly that need. For those of you who are completely new to this human subject stuff, NIH has a computer-based short course that will take you through a lot of the issues, educate you, and then at the end of it, if you pass the quizzes, you get a certificate, which is what was mentioned here as part of what you need to include in your data request. So that's, I think, a start. Western IRB is a commercial entity that serves as an IRB for institutions without their own. So it is possible to do all of this if you don't have your own.
Yeah, I guess my question was similar to Monique's, but kind of more specific with regard to, for those potential researchers who don't have an IRB as part of their institution, what do they do to get an IRB exemption or an IRB approval?
Even the government has to hire IRBs.
Right.
And it's really not that bad. Yeah. Really, it's just cover work. It's really great. Some of you sound nervous. It's not that bad.
Yeah. Further questions on this session? Yes, Dan.
I think just as a comment, it may be useful for Sharp2 or Virginia Tech to come up with a list of the private IRBs like Western IRB that reviews these kinds of things for consulting firms that may not have those resources.
That's good. That's very straightforward. Anybody else on the panel want to have any last words on this subject? Okay, let's declare it's break time. Don't stand up yet. We shall come back at 3:15, and the next session is going to be very much like this one. It's going to be working with the actual data, formulating your data request back and forth with C3 and Virginia Tech to get that satisfied, getting the data in hand. How does all this work? 3:15.